The reading is Joel chapter 3, beginning at verse 1 and reading right through to verse 21. And that can be found on page 922 of your Bibles. That's Joel chapter 3, beginning at verse 1. For behold, in those days and at that time, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my heritage, Israel, because they have scattered them among the nations and have divided up my land and have cast lots for my people and have traded a boy for a prostitute and have sold a girl for wine and have drunk it. What are you to me, O Tyre and Sidon, and all the regions of Philistia? Are you paying me back for something? If you are paying me back, I will return your payment on your own head swiftly and speedily. For you have taken my silver and my gold and have carried my rich treasures into your temples. You have sold the people of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks in order to remove them far from their own border. Behold, I will stir them up from the place to which you have sold them, and I will return your payment on your own head. I will sell your sons and your daughters into the hand of the people of Judah, and they will sell them to the Sabaeans, to a nation far away, for the Lord has spoken. Proclaim this among the nations. Consecrate for war. Stir up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am a warrior. Hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather yourselves there. Bring down your warriors, O Lord. Let the nations stir themselves up and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Go in, tread, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their evil is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. The Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth quake. But the Lord is a refuge to his people, a stronghold to the people of Israel. So you shall know that I am the Lord your God who dwells in Zion, my holy mountain, and Jerusalem shall be holy, and strangers shall never again pass through it. And in that day the mountains shall drip sweet wine, and the hills shall flow with milk, and all the stream beds of Judah shall flow with water, and a fountain shall come forth from the house of the Lord and water the valley of Shittim. Egypt shall become a desolation and Edom a desolate wilderness for the violence done to the people of Judah, because they have shed innocent blood in their land. But Judah shall be inhabited forever, and Jerusalem to all generations. I will avenge their blood, blood I have not avenged, for the Lord dwells in Zion.
Thank you, Alison, for reading so clearly for us. And perhaps we could keep our Bibles open at Joel chapter 3. That's page 922. Now, this is the last in our series of four talks looking at the book of Joel. And if you've been here at all over these last few weeks, then hopefully you've begun to see that it's a really important book to be studying, because Joel places the day of the Lord, in other words, the day on which God will judge his enemies and save his people, firmly on the horizon. And more than that, he shows us how we should be living our lives now in the light of that future day. It's a book in which God says to us, don't just live for the present, but live your life now in the light of the future. And of course, the problem for us, certainly for me, but I guess for all of us, is that we are very good at living simply for the present. It was a most unlikely spat in the papers a couple of weeks ago. You may well have spotted it in the form of an article written by Eric Robson, chairman of Radio 4's Gardeners Question Time. Now, I have to say I'm not at all interested in gardens, as a trip to our house will testify, but I was intrigued nonetheless by the way in which the gentle, genteel world of Gardeners Question Time had been so shaken as this chap, Eric Robson, unleashed his venom on Charlie Dimmock and her like, who edits and creates garden makeover programmes. And this is what he said of Ground Force and Charlie Dimmock. He said they peddle the fiction that gardening can be instant, that you can rip up your innocent suburban garden and redecorate it as if it were your living room, complete with the decking, the blue gravel, the solitary plant shivering next to the obligatory water feature. It isn't just ugly, but hopelessly short-termist. Well, I'm sorry if you spent your bank holiday just buying the decking and kind of laying it all out. Take heart, there's another one coming up in 3 weeks' time, so you can rip it all up again. But Joel is a great book to look at in our short-termist culture, because it is about the future. The warning that Joel gives us is about the future, as he says that the judgment is coming, and the promise that he gives us is about the future, as he says that everyone who has called out to God to save them on that day will be saved. However, if you have been with us for these last 3 weeks, you'll know that so far what we have had in Joel is only warnings and promises. As he's been saying, look, the day of the Lord is going to come. Well, now in this final chapter, in chapter 3, we see the day of the Lord itself. And just so you know where we're going, there's an outline on one of the pieces of paper you'll have been given. First of all, the Valley of Judgment. The Valley of Judgment. Have a look again at Joel chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. For behold, in those days and at that time, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I'll enter into judgment with them there. Well, here is the courtroom scene as God assembles the nations for judgment. Now, I'm very conscious that some of us will switch off as soon as we hear mention of the word judgment, assuming that such language simply has no place in the modern world. However, we saw a couple of weeks ago in Joel that Joel, as well as being a God of perfect love, is also a God of perfect justice. Indeed, imagine for a moment a God who wasn't just. A God who is all-powerful, that's what we've been thinking about so far this morning, isn't it? That he is all-powerful. But imagine a God who was all-powerful, but not just. Why, it would make, wouldn't it, the outrage caused by the ill treatment of Iraqi prisoners look totally insignificant. A God who isn't just would make Joseph Stalin look harmless. But remember that God is also a God of perfect love, which is why he warns us of the coming judgment. Indeed, the climax of Joel, back in chapter 2, we saw is where God pleads with us. Even at this point, he says, when judgment is imminent, return to me. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. It's why, as we'll see today, judgment is portrayed so vividly in Joel. Because, of course, it looks to us, doesn't it, as if the world will simply carry on and on, one day following another, as it always has done. And God in his love wants us to wake up and return to him before the judgment comes. So then chapter 3 describes the day of judgment, the day when that opportunity to return to God will be lost once and for all. And we see, don't we, just in those first two verses that I read, that the living God is clearly sovereign over all the nations of the world as he calls all of them to account. He's not simply a local deity
or the God only of those who call themselves Christians. No, he assembles all the nations for judgment. And notice that as the courtroom is described in verses 1 and 2, there is no jury, because of course the judge is God Almighty, and so there is no danger that perfect justice will not be done. There's no risk of a miscarriage of justice. There's no danger that his judgments will prove unsafe. And there are no clever stunts pulled by scheming lawyers who know the tricks of the trade. It is an awesome scene as the nations are gathered together in the valley of Jehoshaphat. That literally means the valley where the Lord judges. So I take it we're not meant to get out our atlas and kind of flick through the pages and put the pin in the exact place. Rather, we are to imagine in our mind's eye this awesome scene to understand that God is judging the nations. In the words of verse 12, let the nations stir themselves up and come to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. And then in verses 9 to 16, the judgment is described. Indeed, God calls upon the nations to fight him. Verse 9. Proclaim this among the nations. Consecrate for war. Stir up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am a warrior. Hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather yourselves there. Bring down your warriors, O Lord. Can you see what God is saying? Verse 9, bring all your men. Verse 10, declare a state of total war. Yes, even the weaklings, they'll need to fight as well. Verse 11, come out and fight. It's almost a scene of comedy, isn't it? As if they really think that when God comes out fighting, as if they really think they have a chance of winning. Of course they can't. And that is why, as Joel goes on to describe this huge battle on the final judgment day, that actually there is no battle. All they hear is God declaring his verdict. Verse 13. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Go in, tread, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their evil is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. The Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth quake. Now, these verses are a deliberate echo of chapter 2, verse 2, where the locust attack on God's people, which we were thinking about back in chapter 2, was described. It was described as a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness. Because the day of the Lord that God's people suffered as a trial run, if you like, in the locust plague, is now in chapter 3 unleashed in full force upon the nations. No trial run. Rather, this is the real thing. After all, verse 13, the nations are ripe for judgment. Verse 14, all that needs to happen is for God to decide their fate. It's almost an anticlimax, isn't it? There's no battle between good and evil. All that God has to do is to speak, or more precisely, to roar, verse 16. And the full force of his judgment is unleashed upon them. And I take it that if the natural world is convulsed in the way in which it is described in verse 15, then clearly mere men and women have no chance at all of survival. And just in case we're in any doubt, then Joel clearly portrays this as the courtroom to which all of us are heading. Verse 2, all the nations are gathered. Verse 14, multitudes will assemble. And of course, that is why it's such an important chapter for us to be looking at this morning. All the nations, not just a few, the whole world gathered for judgment by God. That is where Joel tells us all of us are heading, unless we have returned to God by putting our trust in Jesus Christ. Indeed, the book of Revelation at the end of the Bible describes the final judgment day in exactly these same terms. So why not keep a finger in Joel chapter 3 and turn on to Revelation 14 on page 1245. And here we see Jesus Christ himself, who is described in Revelation 14 as the Son of Man. Here we see Jesus Christ himself directing the angels to act in judgment, using exactly the same language that Joel uses. So Revelation 14, verse 14, John writes, "Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a Son of Man, Jesus Christ, with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hands. And another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, 'Put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe.' So he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, the angel who has authority over the fire. And he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle, 'Put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, for its grapes are ripe.' So the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the grape harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God." It is an awesome picture. God is sovereign over the nations. He will judge those who refuse to turn to him. I wonder if you've yet planned your summer holiday. Perhaps a gîte in France. Perhaps walking the Alps. Possibly going to the States and taking advantage of a weak dollar. Or going further afield. Well, God will judge the nations. The French waiter, the US taxi driver, the Italian tour guide, yes, even the respectable inhabitants of London. They will all be there if they haven't cried out to God on that day, the Valley of Judgment. Well, secondly, let's move on, the vindication of God's people. And as we return to this courtroom scene, let's remember that Joel throughout is pleading with us to return to God. And just as he tells us about the judgment in order to help us to see the consequences of not turning to him, so too he now wants us to know what is in store if we do return to him, because he wants to show us the rightness of doing that. He wants us to see that God's people will be vindicated on that day. Do you remember back in chapter 2, verse 16, how Joel was calling on the people to return to God, to say to God, "Spare your people, O Lord, and make not your heritage a reproach, a byword among the nations. Why should they say among the peoples, 'Where is their God?'" And I guess some of us here this morning have perhaps thought that of Christians. Where is your God? And no doubt many of us have faced others asking exactly that question. Well, now in chapter 3 we see the final vindication of those who have returned to God and who have put their trust in Jesus Christ. So have a look again at verse 1. "For behold, in those days and at that time, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem..." Yes, says Joel, the nations will be gathered for judgment, but what he really wants us to know is that the fortunes of God's people will be restored. And we see that in more detail as the charges against the nations are read out in this court scene. Verse 2, I'll gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I'll enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my heritage Israel, because they have scattered them among the nations and have divided up my land and have cast lots for my people and have traded a boy for a prostitute and have sold a girl for wine and have drunk it. Yes, he will judge those who conquered his people, who stole their land, and who enslaved their children. And we see a similar thing in verses 5 and 6, as God reads out yet more charges against the nations. Verse 5, for you have taken my silver and my gold, and have carried my rich treasures into your temples. You have sold the peoples of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks, in order to remove them far from their own border. What are the silver, the gold, and the riches they have stolen from God? Well, they're the things they've stolen from God's people, as they ransacked the temple and sold God's people into slavery. They were attacking God himself. Can you see what God is saying? He says to them, you've made a serious error. You thought they were any old people. But no, they were my people. When you took the gold and the silver and the treasures from the temple, when you opened the bottles of champagne rejoicing in your newfound riches, how wrong you were, because you were robbing me. Well, it shows, doesn't it, how closely God associates himself with his people. It's a marvellous thing, you see. God is not disinterested or detached or indifferent towards his people. He is not an all-powerful God who kind of sits up in the heavens somewhere, who doesn't relate to his people. No, he will judge the nations for the way they have treated his people. He will repay them, verse 7. I'll return your payment on your own head. And if all this sounds rather far removed from us, Jesus Christ said a very similar thing. I wonder if you remember how in Matthew 25, he too spoke of the end of time, when God will judge the world, and how he will welcome some into his heaven, but others, how he'll reject them and say, depart from me. And Jesus went on to explain, for I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger and you did not welcome me. Naked and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison and you did not visit me. And the people ask him, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison? And Jesus replies, whatever you did not do for the least of one of these brothers of mine, you did not do for me. God sees how people ill-treat those who belong to him, how indifferent to the needs of God's people they are. And God says, I'll call you to account for the way you have treated my people. And he says that my people, his people, will be vindicated. Well, I wonder, as Alison read, whether you notice the extraordinary contrast that is there in verse 16. Did you notice how, on the one hand, the Lord roars from Zion as he executes judgments, but at the same time, the Lord is a refuge to his people, a stronghold to the people of Israel. Because this is the one place of refuge on that day when the Lord comes to judge. The refuge is God himself. And I wonder if you notice too how God promises those who do seek refuge with him a glorious future. Verse 17, they'll be protected from all harm. There'll be no more strangers in the city. The threat from the nations will be gone forever. Verse 18, they'll be completely satisfied. Can you see some of those words in verse 18? A wonderful picture of life, abundant life. Life as it should be lived. Indeed, life as it will one day be lived by those who have taken refuge in God. Here is a picture, if you like, of the Garden of Eden restored, a beautiful land a land with streams running through it, God dwelling with his people. But of course, Joel is not looking back to the Garden of Eden. Rather, as we saw last week, he is looking forward to heaven, the vindication of God's people. You see, if we're here this morning as followers of Jesus Christ, it's really important, isn't it, that for us, Joel shows us what the judgment day will mean. I was looking at this month's copy of Evangelicals Now just last week, and the catalogue of suffering endured by so many of God's people across the world. So in Indonesia, I was reading of motorcyclists wielding machetes who have attacked Christians, leaving a mother of two children dead and five others injured. I was reading how in Jordan, a Christian widow is under legal threat of being forced to surrender her two children to a Muslim guardian and be thrown into jail. I was reading how in Laos, Christians in the southern province of Atepo have faced increasing persecution and sent letters pleading for help. Well, they need to know, don't they, that actually on the judgment day, that God's people will be vindicated. And we need to know it too, because it's so easy for us to feel the pressure of being Christian, to feel the opposition, perhaps especially in the context of being a prophet. You'll remember that last week Joel was looking forward to the day when all of God's people would be prophets, when all of them will have the task of calling on people to return to Jesus Christ before it is too late, before he returns to judge. But it's so easy not to do that, isn't it? I speak for myself, and I'm sure I speak for many of us. So easy to feel the weight of our secular culture sort of bearing down upon us. It's so easy to simply perhaps keep quiet about the fact that we're Christians. Or even to feel slightly embarrassed and apologetic as someone says, well, surely you don't believe in that, do you? Or perhaps as we try and invite people along to events here at St. Helens. And Joel says you need to keep your eyes fixed on the judgment day, because it will mean the vindication of God's people. On that day, you will see the rightness of following Jesus Christ. You will see how right you were to risk your reputation, your social reputation perhaps, with some of your friends, or even your career. How right you were not to be bothered by what your colleagues thought of you as you tried to talk to them about Jesus Christ. How right you were to make a stand against the cultural pressure to keep quiet and simply fit in with everyone else. How right you were to keep praying for those who have yet to turn to Jesus Christ. Yes, even how right Fred and Claire Tao are to want to bring up Harriet in such a way that she has every opportunity to follow Jesus Christ for herself. The vindication of God's people. Or thirdly, the victory of God. The victory of God. Because this final chapter of Joel presents us with a marvellous picture of the victorious God who rules his world from the heavens. It's a big theme in Joel. God is exercising his rule over the nations from his heavenly city. So have a look at verse 17. So you shall know, says God, that I am the Lord your God, who dwells in Zion, my holy mountain. Verse 21. I will avenge their blood, blood I have not avenged, for the Lord dwells in Zion. On that day, everyone will see that God is God, and that is the note on which Joel ends. That God will establish himself forever with his people in his city, with all they need to live securely and rejoicing in his presence and all that he has done for them. And it is God's presence in his city that guarantees the judgment on his enemies as well as the vindication of his people on that day. Just as in the New Testament we read that it is the resurrection of Jesus Christ and his subsequent ascension into heaven that are the guarantee of universal judgment and the vindication of God's people. This week has seen the rather muted 7th anniversary of Tony Blair's 1997 election triumph. So muted you may even have gone through the week without noticing it. Well, if you were in this country 7 years ago, cast your mind back to that day, at the beginning of May 1997, and you see, how did you know who had won the election and who was now ruling the country? Well, surely it was when you saw those pictures, wasn't it, of Tony Blair standing on the front doorstep of 10 Downing Street. It was when you saw that he had established himself as resident and that he was now ruling the country from there. Well, in a far greater way, Joel finishes by showing us the living God himself ruling the nations from his eternal city. Joel assures us that God rules his world from heaven, and on that final day, he will be seen to be victorious. And because God is dwelling in heaven, then we can be absolutely confident that although Joel is an uncomfortable book, that nonetheless, everything that Joel speaks of reality. The reality of a glorious future. If we know Jesus Christ as our refuge, yes, we can be confident that he will keep us on that day and that there will be abundant life with him in heaven. But also the reality for those this morning who do not know God as their refuge, in which case you need to hear, as Joel tells us, that one day, whatever you think of God now, and however you treat his people, that he will call you to account to settle your destiny. And if you're not prepared for that day, if you haven't returned to God by calling out to him, then that will be a terrible day. And Joel urges us all to be prepared for that day when we come face to face with the living God. We've seen over these last 4 weeks, he assures us it could be any time. He tells us it is imminent. And so the question for each one of us is simple. It is, am I ready? Let's pray together.